Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. All around this planet's warm middle, the tropics, coral reefs ring islands and follow coastlines. Australia's Great Barrier Reef is the greatest example, the only earthly life visible from space. Coral reefs are the forests of the ocean. A quarter of all the world's fish roam and feed off them. They are the major source of protein for 500 million humans. Thanks to us all, they are dying. Outside Magazine just published an obituary for the Great Barrier Reef. Passed away in 2016 after a long illness. Not true, scientists say. It's still alive. But the prognosis is lousy. This hour on Point, the not-so-slow death of the world's coral reefs and the Great Barrier Reef on the brink. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you read the Outside Magazine obituary for the Great Barrier Reef? Did you despair, or is this the kick in the pants we need to save the world's coral reefs? Have you dived through the coral? What did you see there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We should say we contacted Outside Magazine last week to ask them about the obit, spoof, or satire mistake. Satire, they said. Joining me now from Brisbane in Queensland, Australia, is Stephanie Smale. She covers environmental issues for ABC, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Stephanie, sorry about the time difference. Thank you very much for joining us. How have Australian scientists or beyond responded to the Outside Magazine obit for your Great Barrier Reef?
Hi, Tom. Well, there's been quite a lot of frustration from scientists here. Members of the public, maybe not as much of a backlash, and politicians in Australia were even more quiet. But scientists are very frustrated. As you mentioned in your introduction, the Great Barrier Reef is huge, and this mass coral bleaching has really only devastated the central and northern parts of the reef. So they've called this article untrue, damaging, false reporting and irresponsible. So probably the angriest response was from the head of the government agency in charge of the reef's management. And he said, he pointed that out, that, you know, the damage is variable across this huge area. Terry Hughes, who's another sort of world-renowned scientist who's based up in Townsville next door to the reef, he said that he got the impression from this article that the message was to give up on the reef, that it was already dead. But he said now it's more important than ever to continue and increase efforts to save the reef.
I'm looking, Terry Hughes here, as you say, the Australian researcher says you don't write the obituary of a loved one when they're diagnosed with a serious illness. You help them fight for their life. But it's a real fight, Stephanie. From everything we're reading here, something like a quarter of the reef, 22% bleached and in big trouble. Your federal and Queensland governments, I'm reading here in The Guardian, they've given the Great Barrier Reef a D on a report card for its overall health for the fifth year in a row. I mean, there's real trouble under the sea there.
There absolutely is. And those, you know, really high sea temperatures have devastated parts of the far north of the reef. There's no doubt about that. So as a reporter in March this year, scientists started sending me in photos of reefs that were once vibrant and colourful that had been bleached this ghostly white. It was quite incredible to see. And as the year has progressed through, so some of that coral, well, especially the northern reaches, an alarming amount has died and now has brown algae. Now, obviously, if coral has died, it's not going to recover. However, those alarming statistics that more than 90% of the entire reef has been bleached to some extent doesn't mean that it can't bounce back. So I feel like there is optimism coming through from the hundreds of scientists that are out there on the reef at the moment, because this is a huge monitoring time on the reef. They are already seeing signs of regrowth, of bounce back, this close after the event. So parts of that reef, parts of the reef haven't been as badly affected. It's definitely alarming, and that's obviously what this article is saying, sort of a wake-up call, but it is important to get the message out there that the whole reef isn't devastated. There is parts that are bad, but there are parts that are not that bad.
Remind us, I mean, people can vaguely sort of picture this, but we're talking about an enormous stretch of the Australian coast there, up from that tip down something like 1,400 miles in the northeast of Australia. How important is the Great Barrier Reef for Australian to Australia economically and for that matter environmentally, just for the sustenance of your biodiversity there?
Sure thing. Well, I think even emotionally, the reef is a huge part of Queensland and Australia's identity. But in terms of finances, it's a huge money spinner for Queensland and Australian tourism. So reef tourism generates about $3 billion every year. About 70,000 jobs come from either direct touring or business from flow-ons like food and hospitality in those reef regions like Cairns and Port Douglas and Townsville. There's more than 1,500 different marine species that live there, and that, you know, that's reason for people to come from all over the world. So this is a huge money spinner and obviously worrying to governments and locals and business people. If it's not going to be there anymore, where will that money come from?
And what does it mean emotionally to Australians there along that very long stretch where the Great Barrier Reef is such a big deal?
Well, there's a huge sense of pride. I mean, it's, as in the statistics you were mentioning in your intro, it's quite an extraordinary world icon. It's a World Heritage Area. There's, you know, marine species and ecosystems that you can find here that you can't find anywhere else in the world. A really good example is David Attenborough's awareness and repeated visits to the Great Barrier Reef. His documentary recently, Charlie Verrin, who's another really well-known coral scientist, said that David Attenborough's favourite place in the world, and he told him that and he really believed that. So it's a spectacular, unique marine jewel, I guess, that even the world's most famous scientists and presenters acknowledge.
And does saving it, if it is to be saved, what does that rely on? Are we talking mainly about Australian pollution? I'm reading here about runoff from sugarcane fertilization, runoff from grazing. Is it local pesticides? Is it local damage, or are we talking about global climate change and even weather patterns, El Nino, that's most hitting your Great Barrier Reef?
It sounds very overwhelming, doesn't it?
Yes.
There's different levels. So our scientists are saying long term climate change is the factor. So that governments of all levels need to start working towards reducing greenhouse gases, really fighting climate change. But on a more sort of now response, governments are focusing on that runoff. So there's a big focus on water quality at the moment. So that's targeting farms, so sugarcane, grazing, horticulture. They want to reduce fertilizer and sediment runoff. They're even looking at moves like fining farms that are shown not to be improving their farm management practices, not keeping more soil on their farms, things like that, which is considered quite a dramatic move here. But it's seen that if water is good quality, then coral can bounce back easier from dramatic events like this mass coral bleaching event. But I recently, last week in fact, went to the most southern tip of the Great Barrier Reef, and it was one of the places that has only had its normal bleaching for the year. So, you know, the sort of average coral die-off for the year, and it is still alive and thriving. I snorkeled around that region. Turtles, dolphins are there, not millions, but thousands of different types of fish, and it's still really a strong sign of how big the reef is and how different the layers of impact are there.
Stephanie, in brief, so not dead yet, your scientists say, but are you confident that it will be saved, or does it appear to be at risk of even dying?
I think there are parts that have already died in this particular mass bleaching event, but I do believe that there are also other areas that are already bouncing back, and I believe that because it is a living organism, and well, from what scientists are saying anyway, it's a living organism and it has the potential to bounce back if it's given the right tools.
We will put our hope in that. Stephanie Smale with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, in Brisbane, Australia. Stephanie, thank you so much at this tough hour for you for being with us. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's go to Washington right now. And Mark Eakin, coordinator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Reef Watch. Mark Eakin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
What did you think when you first saw the obit from Outside Magazine? Great Barrier Reef, 25 million years old, has passed away in 2016 after a long illness. Your first reaction?
Well, the headline was shocking, but that's what headlines do. They grab your attention. Started reading through, and my mind immediately went to Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, one mm-hmm. of the most famous bits of satire ever written. And it was clear to me that this was satire. Nobody was saying it at that point. But what I don't like is the potential that it can make people think that it's too late for the reef. What I do like is the fact that it's drawing attention to a major problem that we've been watching, especially as this global bleaching event's been going on for over 2 years now.
I want to take some time and look at this global bleaching and what exactly that is. But is the life of the Great Barrier Reef, and for that matter, coral all over the world, is it wholesale at risk? Could we read a legitimate obituary like this in 10, 20, 30 years? It's done. It's dead.
Well, I wouldn't go as early as 30, but, you know, at this point, we're really looking at corals suffering all over the world and a lot of the coral reefs really being at risk. So I'm concerned that, you know, there will be the potential for legitimate obituaries in some areas in the future. In the meantime, we need to be working to try and avoid that. And that's the good side of an article like this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the recent obituary for the once-thriving Great Barrier Reef off Australia. Scientists say, wait, it's not dead, but it is in trouble, like much of the world's coral now. Mark Eakin is with us. He's coordinator of the Coral Reef Watch at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You can join us this hour as well. Have you swum, snorkeled the Great Barrier Reef, great coral anywhere that's now in trouble? And what did you see there? Are we going to just let the coral, the reefs, die? Go all the way back to 1968. Here was explorer, documentary filmmaker Jacques Cousteau. In an episode of his TV show, The Underworld Sea of Jacques Cousteau, he and his men are in the South Asian island chain of the Maldives, exploring coral reefs just teeming with life. Schools of tiny, colorful fish and fast-crawling sea urchins, gangs of parrotfish and more, and humans, islanders, tearing up the corals to build homes. If Cousteau went back today, we wonder what he would find.
Our first dive in a world so physically striking overwhelms our senses. We are no more explorers, but children in a store filled with surprises. We stop at random to look at the busy traffic in the crowded cities.
Children in a store filled with surprises under the sea. We're not kids anymore when it comes to understanding what's going on with the seas. And a lot has changed since 1968. Just last year, Sir David Attenborough, the naturalist and broadcaster, produced a three-part documentary on the Great Barrier Reef for the BBC. Over the course of his lifetime, he's dived that great reef and seen it change. The problem, rising temperatures, acidity in the ocean waters, and more.
60 years ago, I dived on the reef for the first time. And ever since, it has held a deep fascination for me. But in the intervening years, I've witnessed the reef reacting to a rapidly changing planet.
There's the documentarian view. For those who live and work on the sea, they're some of the first to witness the effects of climate change and more on coral reefs. Here's one fisherman, Ricky Dean, last year mourning for the coral reef.
Nobody really cares. You know, everyone treats the sea like it's a gold mine, and they just go there and get what they want, destroy it. The coral reefs have changed so much. They get full of algae and looks like they're dying. There's no fish like before.
Looks like they're dying. No fish like before. Mark Eakin is with us from the NOAA Coral Reef Watch. Mark, what is most assaulting coral reefs in the Great Barrier Reef and beyond?
The biggest impact really is coming from climate change. The rising temperatures of the ocean all around the world has been bringing corals closer to their thermal limits, so the limit above which they no longer can function well, and when bleaching occurs, and if the bleaching's bad enough and lasts long enough, they die. You started this out a few minutes ago with the Jacques Cousteau. Mm-hmm. If he had been back in the Maldives this year, he would have seen extreme bleaching going on. Swimming across that beautiful reef, he would have seen, instead of beautifully colored corals, he would have seen stark white corals all over until many of them started to die. And we've been seeing that globally now for over 2 years as a part of this global bleaching event that the reefs are undergoing right now and that hit the Great Barrier Reef so hard.
What is bleaching exactly?
So first, let's consider what a coral is. You start with a children's game 20 questions. Is it animal, vegetable, or mineral?
Right.
And the answer is all three, yes. Mm-hmm. It's an animal, and living inside its tissue are microscopic algae, and the combination of those algae called zooxanthellae along with the coral are what are able to allow them to build these limestone or calcium carbonate skeletons that build these huge reef structures that are so important. Well, when the temperatures get too high, the corals and their algae get stressed, and the algae start to release compounds that are toxic to the coral. The coral then ejects the algae into the water. It leaves the coral damaged. It leaves them starving because they've lost their main food source, mm-hmm. which is what comes from the algae. And they're more susceptible to disease. Now, if it's brief, if it's short term, if conditions go back to normal, the corals can regenerate or regrow their zooxanthellae. However, they are more likely to get disease at this point. If the event is long-lasting or is really severe, then the corals start to die directly from this. And early this year, we were seeing in Fiji where there were some reefs in the inner lagoons where the water was heating up so fast that corals were going from apparently healthy to dead in 2 weeks.
Well, you and Stephanie Smale with us from Brisbane, Australia, a few minutes ago, both talk about this bleaching event. What is the global bleaching event that we're in the midst of right now?
So we had widespread, potentially global bleaching in 1983 at the time of the big El Nino that occurred. The first real global event, widespread, well-recognized, and well-documented, was in 1998. Again, a big El Nino event. And that raised temperatures around the world and then was followed by a La Nina that warmed waters that normally cool during an El Nino. So some areas warmed during La Nina, and so they got nailed in the same year. You move forward to 2010, we had a bleaching event during a moderate El Nino that, again, was global in nature. Now, 2014, we started this event. There has been bleaching going on continuously in the world's oceans since June of 2014, when it started in Guam and the Mariana Islands, the two parts of the U.S. Mm-hmm. in the far western yep. Pacific. And it has been going continuously since then. It has moved through all of the world's oceans, the Indian, the Pacific, and the Caribbean Atlantic Basin, which that's what, for us, makes it a global event. It hits all three big basins. It did that by the fall of 2015, when it was truly a global event. It has repeated that cycle again in 2016. We've got major bleaching going on right now in the Marshall Islands and eastern Micronesia. So, you know, we've got places that are continuing to bleach now. This event is not yet over.
What's the connection between climate change and the El Nino or Niños that are producing this bleaching, perhaps death?
Well, there's a very complicated question there, which is, does climate change affect El Nino? And the question is, maybe. We don't need to worry about that. What we do know,
really?
We don't have to worry about it as far as the question of corals in this year. So we know that El Nino is a part of the natural cycle. You have warm years in parts of the Pacific that leads to climate impacts around the world. La Nina can do the reverse, but it actually warms parts of the western Pacific, so you have bleaching in the west at times of a La Nina, as we've moved into now. Those are natural cycles. So those are the kinds of upswings and downswings that you always have naturally. But instead of being around a flat baseline, the temperatures in the ocean and the amount of heat the ocean has absorbed has been increasing dramatically through global warming. And so whether or not they're more El Ninos or more severe or whatever, even if they're just happening at the normal rate, they're happening on warmer and warmer temperatures. So you've gone up the steps a ways, and you're that much closer to the temperature at which bleaching occurs before the El Nino happens. So this event started long before the El Nino did. The El Nino didn't get going until 2015, and this bleaching event had been going on for about 9 months before that.
You've got agencies now saying that 22% of the Great Barrier Reef is dead. That sounds like a lot to me as a layman. You talked about a thermal limit in terms of temperature. I mean, how close are we getting to an actual pervasive die-off here?
That is a big concern we have. You're right. 22% is a number that alarms me as a scientist as well. That is a lot of coral in the Great Barrier Reef. And the Great Barrier Reef didn't get hit as badly as some places. There are some places in the mid-Pacific that we're talking 80 or 95% mortality, you know, dead corals at those numbers.
So maybe Outside Magazine is not so far off the mark.
They're exaggerating.
80 to 90% dead? Is that what you're saying? Well, okay. I don't want to be 80 or 90% dead.
No. And that's not the Great Barrier Reef. This is Central Pacific where those numbers are. But there are parts of the Great Barrier Reef that got that high. So, you know, they're premature in calling it dead. It's satire. I'm glad to hear that they've admitted it's satire. It does its job as satire of getting people's attention, which is very valuable. But, you know, we are concerned at this point. The temperatures are continuing to warm. The amount of heat the ocean has absorbed is not something that it can give up easily. So that has warmed the oceans and is continuing to warm the oceans. And we're moving that much closer to a time where bleaching becomes a common event rather than an uncommon event.
Ruth Gates joins us in just a moment from Hawaii, where she's been all over this challenge and how a response can be shaped, grand scale, but also micro scale, right down there with individual bits of coral. Mark Eakin is with us from NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. Robert is calling from Davie, Florida, where they know something about reefs and coral. Robert, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I'm okay, though. This kind of news, satire or not, is very troubling.
Well, I hate to come across as a cynic, but I saw the post that you're referring to. And I think it's premonition more than anything, if it's going to happen, but when. And it's sad to see that human beings choose to use the Mother Earth, and especially all the bodies of water, as their personal dumping ground for things that they're done with and don't ever want to see. People have some kind of an inner belief that when you throw something in a lake, or in the river or in the ocean, and it goes away, carried by the tide or sunk to the bottom, it no longer exists. And what we're doing is we're killing a source of life where we all came from. And like I said, I hate to be a cynic. I love the ocean.
Robert, we're losing you right there, but we've got plenty of callers from Florida on this one. Many, but on this one. Brendan in Sunrise, Florida. Thanks. You're on, Brendan.
Hi, am I on the air?
Yes, you're on the air, sir.
Hi, Tom, thank you.
Yes.
All right. I basically just wanted to say, why are people so unwilling to accept that climate change is a real thing? It's really impacting our oceans here in Florida, really affecting our coral reefs here in Florida, especially in the Key West. So many people are unwilling to really just accept that that climate change is really affecting a lot of America. Why is that?
Brendan, I appreciate your call as well. Mark Eakin there, too, from Florida. Saying, I mean, our first caller says this to his mind is a premonition of what's coming. And you hear Brendan, why do we accept it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, climate change is something that is real. It's something that humans are the major contributor to. And it's something that we really need to be dealing with and should have been dealing with much more strongly a couple of decades ago. But the other caller, right on as far as the pollution, because the other problem that we have going on is it's not just climate change, but at the same time, it's pollution that we're putting into the waters, it's problems of overfishing and improper fishing, you know, some damaging fishing techniques, and it's also habitat destruction. These are all affecting coral reefs, and unfortunately, all of them are affecting them to the negative. And so these are all things we need to be dealing with. It's not just a climate problem.
New York, Endwell, New York, Harriet is on the line. Harriet, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I unfortunately I'm not very good at remembering where I saw or read things, but I had seen something about efforts being made to regrow, to revitalize reefs by plugging in some resistant algae into reefs that are, you know, in trouble, and it's been quite successful in revitalizing the reef, that these things grow and quite quickly.
Yeah. Harriet, I'm so glad you raised that. We've got a global expert on that with us right now. And let me go to her. Mark Eakin, standby in Washington. I want to turn to Honolulu, Hawaii. Harriet, thank you very much for that. Ruth Gates is with us, president of the International Society for Reef Studies, director of the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. She runs a coral nursery preserving species of indigenous coral now thought to be extinct in the Hawaiian Islands, also collaborating with Madeleine Van Oppen at the Australian Institute of Marine Science to breed corals that will be better adapted to a warming ocean. Ruth Gates, thank you very much for being with us from Hawaii just now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Is it true that you can breed, cultivate climate change-resistant coral? And can you do it at a scale that could take on the challenge?
It's a great question. And I think that, you know, you're hitting on a point that is so important. We can focus all we like on the problem, but until we start solving it, we don't really know what the outcome will be. And so, you know, our position is that we need to start doing things in short order that get us to a potential solution, and obviously selective breeding of things that appear to be surviving conditions that are killing others is one way to go.
But when I think of how vast the coral reefs of the planet are or have been, can you put enough plugs of new coral out there that they could proliferate and replace what, if it's true that the Great Barrier Reef is 22% dead now, that's a vast amount just there. And you hear Mark Eakin saying you have other places where the devastation is much worse. Can we intervene in a way to make a meaningful countermeasure to that kind of die-off or bleaching?
So, I mean, I think this is a question that is really at the heart of whether you try to do something or you just stop in your tracks before you begin. And I don't think we should really look at the scale and go, it's overwhelming. I think we should attempt to develop strategy, and then we should turn to people who scale for a living to help us actually scale to the size of the problem. I'd just like to point out that there are two sort of separate ways of going.
Okay.
Corals reproduce sexually, and when they do that, you can produce thousands of individual corals in a given reproductive season, so thousands to millions. But the planting of corals generally relies on the alternate reproductive strategy, which is they are clonal organisms. So you can essentially take one coral and cut it into 10 and have 10 genetically identical pieces that can then be planted. And so these two strategies are somewhat separate. But you can imagine that with the sexual reproduction, with the production of thousands to millions of larvae, that you can start to seed reefs that have been damaged with many individuals simultaneously that don't rely on sort of going out and planting a garden.
Can you keep up with the pace of climate change with this kind of work if you're successful? Or are you even, in your vision, is this a smaller amount of coral but survives but at a lesser scale?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that we don't study very comprehensively is the recovery of the reef. We spend a lot of time talking about what's dying, but not what's surviving. And so if you actually go around the world right now, as Mark alluded to, there's 22% death on the Great Barrier Reef. There's 80 to 90% in some islands. And actually, there's less than 5% on some other reefs globally. So understanding this variation is critical to understanding how we move forward to solve. Spending time thinking about survival, not death, I think is going to benefit us enormously.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the recent obituary for the once thriving Great Barrier Reef off Australia. Scientists say, wait, it is not dead, but it is in very serious trouble, like corals all over the world now. Ruth Gates is with us from Honolulu, director of the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. She's working on coral nurseries, looking for species that may be most apt to survive climate change and the challenges in our seas right now. Joins us from Hawaii. Mark Eakin is with us from Washington, coordinator of the NOAA Coral Reef Watch. Also right in the middle of this grand scale. You can join us this hour. Are we just going to let the Great Barrier Reef die? Is coral out of sight, out of mind to you? Can you believe we are perhaps taking down natural features on the scale of Australia's Great Barrier Reef? And will the hopefully premature, or now they say satirical obituary, spur the world to reaction? Here's John Vlahidis from National Geographic's Lonely Planet, diving into the Great Barrier Reef and talking to two tourist divers afterward. When it's great, it's really great.
Here we go. Great Barrier Reef.
We saw fish this big.
or bigger. Clams the size of beach balls, you know. It was pretty cool down there.
Yeah, great when it's cool, but when it's not, terrible. Here's Australian marine biologist, neuroscientist Justin Marshall. He's witnessed the effects of coral bleaching in the Great Barrier Reef. He described it in May.
I've been coming to Lizard Island and coral reefs for about 30 years now, and over that time, we've looked at the colour of the coral and see it go from a healthy brown to an unhealthy white. Coral here on Lizard Island is as unhealthy and white and bleached as I've ever seen it before.
And it's not just off Australia. Here's a moment from a CNN report out of Florida not long ago.
Once known for bright hues and exotic creatures,
there's so much life in every nook and cranny.
Scientists tell us that South Florida's coral reefs are now in rapid decay because a variety of threats are edging this delicate ecosystem closer to collapse.
Ruth Gates and Mark Eakin, so many callers for the two of you from all over the place. Cammy in Lexington, Kentucky. Cammy, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What have you seen?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Basically, I wanted to make a comment. In 07, I had gotten a job offshore on an oil rig. I just romanticized about being in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
And after several weeks of safety training and classes on what you can and can't do, when I got actually on the rig, which was 400 miles off the Gulf Coast, to my dismay, I realized that all rules were thrown out the window, or offshore, I guess I should say. But basically that the men out there, they just weren't really concerned about what was supposed to happen. And many, many things, toxic things, not just food, but chemicals that they didn't want to mess with would get thrown. And I always wonder why people never talk about it. And I guess it's too hard to police out there on these rigs to see what people do. But I always felt like that has to be a huge contribution, because even at night on the rig, I can see hundreds of other lights from other rigs that would be surrounding us like a little city. You feel so alone at the daytime, but at night you realize how many rigs are out there. So if there's other rigs that have the same mentality of just throwing anything offshore that they didn't want to mess with, it's really just heart-wrenching to think what kind of effects that has
Cammy,
on our ocean.
Cammy, I really appreciate your calling in with that witness. Let me hold that direct pollution off of oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico in that case, and get one more right here. Cammy, thank you. Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Dean, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Back in 1989, as a student, biology student from Wisconsin, I went out there, and one of the things...
Out where, Dean? Where'd you go?
We went to Australia in general, but we took a two-week trip out to Cairns to go scuba diving.
Is this the great... So you're talking... You were in the reef, the Great Barrier Reef.
Yep, Great Barrier Reef, yep.
Okay. And what'd you see?
One of the things we noticed was they were dredging this special type of sand. And they were telling us that this sand was highly prized all over the world at resorts to put out on their beach, on their beaches. And they were telling us how that was causing some bleaching of the coral, too. I was just wondering, is that still going on, where they're selling this special sand out there in the world or not?
I don't know about that, but let me ask, and I'll start with you, Ruth, the impact of direct pollution that Cammy describes having seen off of oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, or direct destruction. Dean's talking about dredging there. The impact of that versus climate change, El Nino, rising temperatures. How do you apportion sort of causes of destruction overall, Ruth?
Yes, I mean, the prioritization of stress on reefs, it varies very much from place to place. And so there are some places where pollution and heavy sediment loads associated with dredging will be the greatest threat to coral reefs. There'll be other places that are more remote and less touched by these direct pollutants, that where climate change is undoubtedly the most the largest threat to the reef. But I think, you know, that both of these callers have sort of touched on a point that I think we haven't perhaps done as good a job as we should be doing about informing people why coral reefs are important to them. And I think people only do irresponsible things when they don't understand why they shouldn't. So I think that we fail to tell people that coral reefs are critical to their health. And that is for people all over the planet.
How is that? If I'm not living on the coast of the northeast coast of Australia or near a reef, how is it critical to my health?
You know, the coral reef breathes. It produces oxygen that we breathe. The coral reef produces medicines that we use to treat our human diseases. You know, the coral reef protects land where loads of people live. And if there's no protection, that land goes away and those people will move to another place and there'll be more competition among people. And of course, coral reefs feed people. And food is critical
Lots
to
of
our
people.
Health.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, these are really sort of complex animals because they look like rocks. And so you can understand why people would walk across them thinking I'm walking across a rock. But if we can just get to the heart of educating people a bit more thoroughly about what coral reefs do, what they look like, and why you shouldn't treat them poorly, I think we'll move forward. But of course, the pollution is really either local pollutants, but really on a global scale, carbon dioxide is the pollutant that we're talking about that is changing climate. And we can mitigate all of these things. We can change our behavior and improve the prognosis for reefs quite simply by reducing the burning of fossil fuels and by stopping the activities in coastal waters that are causing direct problems with pollution.
Mark Eakin, you know, we've got the Paris Accord now. Lots and lots of nations are stepping up to agree to very significant downsizing of their fossil fuel pollution, CO2. So many things are affected by the climate change that comes from that CO2. Are coral reefs the early indicator? Are they more vulnerable than other parts of our global ecosystem? Do they depend primarily upon pulling down that burning use of fossil fuels?
They are. They're one of the early indicators. They have been considered a canary in the coal mine. It's interesting that the two areas that are being hit the hardest and the fastest are in the tropics and at the poles. You know, we're in the Arctic, we're seeing a loss of sea ice and the impact on ecosystems there. In the tropics, it's not warming as much, but the organisms there live close to their thermal limits. So they've adapted to those very high conditions and can't get much higher. So what we're looking at now is a situation where carbon dioxide has reached levels that have not been seen in millions of years. We have just heard today or yesterday, I guess, the World Meteorological Organization saying that we have now surpassed 400 parts per million permanently, and we won't get below that again anytime in our lifetimes. We're looking at a Paris Accord that gets ratified and goes into full force on the 4th of November, I believe it is. But the really important thing, the agreement is great, and I am thrilled that that's in place. But the hard part is taking action. What we really need to be doing is reversing course. First, we need to reduce the amount of CO2 being emitted in the atmosphere. We have to then get to the point that we're putting no new CO2 into the atmosphere.
I mean, Donald Trump says he'll throw out the measures in the U.S. that would put America on a path toward that kind of diminution of CO2 emission.
Yes, he does.
So there's one big decision right in front of Americans there. What do they want to do about that?
It absolutely, and you know that has become an issue in this election. But you know, independent of that, what we need to be doing as far as corals are concerned is not just reducing CO2 emissions, but reducing the amount in the atmosphere. In fact, for corals, you know, a lot of people think about 350 parts per million in the atmosphere is all coral reefs can really tolerate. Charlie Varon in Australia said it's about 320. I'll take anything going down from 400 at this point, but we've got a lot of work to do to get to that point.
Ruth, describe your work in the coral nurseries. What are you finding there? How common are lines of coral that might be more warmth and stress resistant? How's it working, Ruth?
Actually, you know, what's so interesting is in places that have been heavily polluted and stressed in the past, we're finding the corals that have recovered from that are seemingly extremely strong at facing current challenges. And, you know, that is evidenced by back-to-back bleaching events in places in Hawaii. And where those corals were previously stressed, those corals have almost completely recovered from both of those bleaching events. So we're focusing on the genotypes or the individual mm-hmm. corals that are doing well, and we're trying a variety of different approaches. Now, we don't know how successful we will be, but I can tell you this, Tom, if we don't do anything, we will maybe have no reefs by 2050. And that is really a consensus statement put out by the majority of the world's coral reef scientists who feel that the reefs will be massively degraded by 2050 if we don't act now.
All right. That's very challenging. If you can find genotypes that are more stress resistant, how do you propagate them globally, Ruth? You've got vast tracts of coral reef, even with all the threat and stress they're under now.
Yes. I mean, I think that the most success will be had where there are lots of people. And so, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of people living on the Great Barrier Reef. And I think this really, you know, alludes to a different challenge that we have emotionally with reefs, is that in some respects, we're going to have to make some decisions about where we put our effort. You know, do we save some coral and be prepared to let go of other parts of the world where coral is?
You mean because unless, you can't plant unless, enough everywhere?
That's right, because mm-hmm. we just cannot get there to do the things that we might need to do. You know, obviously, the thing that we need to do is to mitigate the absolute driver of the problem, which is climate change.
Yes.
But if we go to sort of a biological solution, it will be contingent upon there being a communities of people in places to do lots of things. And, you know,
you mean to dive under the sea and actually, I don't know, what do you do? Do you sort of plug these into the sea bottom somehow?
Yes. I mean, you can work with corals in labs. You can work mm-hmm. with them on the reef. You know, it's a whole field of restoration that's been in play for the last 25 years. This is not new. Mm-hmm. And in some places in the world where the coral reefs have already been massively degraded, people are very successfully planting new reefs and doing it as a sort of a part of their community action. And I guess that's the thing that I feel is often missed when we're talking about reefs, is that people care about them. They understand where they understand that they rely on them. They are prepared to act and do things. And I think we can use that collective action to move the needle towards a better outcome. But it's not a biological solution or a mitigating climate change solution. This is not a competition. We need to do everything in our power right now, biology and climate related, to actually prevent the juggernaut that is really rolling over reefs right now.
Mark Egan, what's the comeback potential for reefs that are deeply bleached out? I mean, you get this 22% dead in the Great Barrier Reef. Can that come back to life? Or does it need an entirely different genotype to come in there if it has any chance at all? What's the comeback potential?
So there are two types of recoveries after bleaching event. First of all, for those corals that haven't died, there's the ability to grow back their zooxanthellae, the microscopic algae, mm-hmm. get their color and be healthy again. But once corals have died, that's a different story. And then you're talking about recovery of reefs. The good news is there have been some stories where we've seen examples of coral reefs being able to bounce back. In 1998, in that big El Nino that caused the first widespread, you know, true global bleaching event, we saw reefs all over the world dying. One particular reef off of Western Australia, Scott Reef, 600 kilometers from shore, over 1,000 kilometers from the nearest city, and cities being generous, they're small places along that part of the coast, long way from everybody. Over the course of about 12 years, the reef that had really been damaged and collapsed as a result of that El Nino was able to recover. Now, the bad news is right now they are out there and are looking at it. There was a huge amount of bleaching and mortality of those corals again this year. So the challenge is being able to have the reefs recover and to grow back faster than the rate at which these events are returning. That's really where we are right now. We're seeing the return of these events so frequently because the temperatures are warming. And so this is where, just as Ruth was saying, we need to be addressing both things. We need to be addressing climate change. We need to be reducing CO2 in the atmosphere. At the same time, we need to be addressing those local stressors, whether it's pollution, overfishing, habitat destruction. And these nursery efforts have been great. NOAA's been involved in nurseries in the Florida Keys and elsewhere in the Caribbean for a decade now. And it's a great way for conservation, but you know, it's tough to scale it all up to that level.
I mean, these reefs and the life around them, from the films and direct snorkeling, I mean, these are the most spectacular displays of nature's splendor I've seen anywhere, Ruth. And you're saying by 2050, globally gone if we don't get on it.
Absolutely, and you're so right. They are the underwater garden, the cathedrals of the ocean.
I guess I wish both of you the best of luck with your work, and I hope all listeners are paying close attention here. That is a lot of beauty and much more than that on the line. Ruth Gates at the University of Hawaii's Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology, thank you very much for being with us from Honolulu today, Ruth.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, Mark Eakin at NOAA's Coral Reef Watch. Thank you, Mark, for joining us.
Thanks for spending an hour on this with us.
Let's save the coral. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.